It's all right. Hi, I'm Jill. I am, I'm going to preach this morning. So, did you hear that the Queen died this week? Maybe? Yeah, I thought you might have. And I've been thinking again about this idea of long obedience as I thought about the life and legacy of Queen Elizabeth. And I'm sure you're pretty acquainted with her life at this point, but I think for the purposes of this conversation, it's important to recognize that she became queen when she was 25. She stayed married to her husband for 73 years, and she reigned for 70. And also recognizing that she didn't even know she was in line for the throne until she was 16 or 18, when her uncle abdicated and put her father in line. And so it's not like she grew up from birth knowing that this was where she was going to end up. And whatever you think of the monarchy or the royals, or even in spite of what you might think of a life of 70 years that's dedicated and committed to duty, it's pretty hard not to admire what can only be characterized as long obedience in the same direction. She was a model of consistency, a mostly pretty quiet, dependable presence in the world. Probably almost everybody in this room has known her to be queen as long as you've been alive. If you haven't, you don't need to say. And she, I don't know what her private life was like, but certainly publicly, she never gave any evidence of kind of railing against what was required or expected of her. She never had periods of acting out. She never, like, yelled at the press or had displays of anger or resentment. And I think that's remarkable. Eugene Peterson was a Christian author who wrote a book a while ago called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. And he explains where he got that phrase. Friedrich Nietzsche, who saw this area of spiritual truth with great clarity, wrote, "The essential thing in heaven and earth is that there should be long obedience in the same direction. In that results, and has always resulted, something which has made life worth living." Peterson argues that the world discourages this long obedience in the same direction. Christians, he says, look for quick results, but shortcuts don't lead to Christian maturity. And I think we'd have to agree, everything in our society calls for new change, options, endless opportunities. We change our homes, our phones, our cars, our jobs, our partners, our friends, sometimes often with little thought. We're addicted to the next best. Even our spirituality can be a constant quest for the new idea, the new paradigm, the new expression of church. And don't misunderstand me, I think spiritual seeking and evolving and looking for new things to learn is good. Learning new ideas and possibilities is part of spiritual growth, but not if it comes out of a restless need that can never be satisfied. Peterson says, there's a great market for religious experience in our world. There is little enthusiasm for the patient acquisition of virtue, little inclination to sign up for a long apprenticeship in what earlier generations of Christians called holiness. I aspire to this idea of long obedience, but mine is a road characterized much more by short bursts of faithful journeying, interrupted at regular intervals by my own need to act out, melt down, weep and rail against my lot, to feel sorry for myself, to feel let down, disappointed, abandoned by the world, abandoned by God. If we have enough grace to assume today that I am mostly pointed in the same direction, my spiritual journey has not been without hills and valleys. My spiritual path is a lot more roller coaster than lazy river. But I suspect that it is closer to the experience of most of us. Fortunate for us who are human, and quite likely to tap out from time to time, there are loads of biblical stories of people of God who failed and fell, who ran away, who needed time to gather and regroup. And Elijah is one of those stories. Now, we haven't spent a lot of time in 1 Kings in the time that I've been here at Eucharist, so you may or may not be familiar with Elijah. So a bit of background about his story. It's long and kind of complicated. The first book of Kings begins with the death of King David, and it tells about what happens in the reigns of this succession of kings from Solomon on. And for the most part, it's just a story of decline. And so the kings get worse and worse, behaving badly, turning away from God. By the time it gets to King Ahab, which is where this story happens, the royal line has hit a new low. Ahab, it says, does more evil in the sight of the Lord than any who were before him. And he's married to Jezebel, which is the daughter of a foreign king, who actually doesn't have a huge role in the Bible, but you know her name because she characterizes every evil woman that has ever been since her. So that's not great. She couldn't have been great. And she leads, together they lead the people in the worship of their god Baal. And this is where Elijah enters the story. He steps up as a prophet, which on the best of days is a tough job. And he prophesies to Ahab that a great drought is going to come and last for years. And so the next few chapters of Kings do play out this parched earth, desperate need for rain. Elijah continues to follow the word of the Lord until finally God sends him back to Ahab for a final showdown. And you might remember this part of the story from Sunday school if that was how you were raised. Elijah has the whole of Israel gather and about 450 prophets of Baal. And he sets up this demonstration. So he builds an altar with a sacrificed bull on it, and the other prophets do the same. And then they each call on their God to set the whole business ablaze. The prophets of Baal shout and cry and dance, and it says they cut themselves and nothing happens. The altar and the bull sit unburnt. And then Elijah, to prove his point, douses water over his sacrifice 3 times. And then when he calls on God to bring down fire, he does. He sends down fire and he consumes it all. And the people see the sign and they confess together that the Lord is indeed God. And then they round up all the prophets of Baal and Elijah kills the lot of them. Which begs a few questions, but that's for another day. So all in all, this is a pretty successful day for Elijah. He's made his point. He's done the job he was asked to do. The people have turned back to God. So here's where we get to the story that I want us to focus on today. So this is 1 Kings 19. I'm going to read it to you. When Ahab got home, he told Jezebel everything Elijah had done, including the way that he had killed all the prophets of Baal. So Jezebel sent this message to Elijah. May the gods strike me and even kill me if by this time tomorrow I have not killed you just as you killed them. Elijah was afraid, and he fled for his life. Then he went on alone into the wilderness, traveling all day. And he sat down under a solitary broom tree and prayed that he might die. I've had enough, Lord, he said. Take my life, for I am no better than my ancestors who are already dead. Then he lay down and slept under the broom tree. And as he was sleeping, an angel touched him and told him, get up and eat. He looked around, and there beside his head was some bread, baked on hot stones, and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. And then the angel of the Lord came again and touched him and said, get up and eat some more, or the journey ahead will be too much for you. So he got up and ate and drank, and the food gave him enough strength to travel 40 days and 40 nights to Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. There he came to a cave where he spent the night. But the Lord said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? And then Elijah replied, I have zealously served the Lord God Almighty, but the people of Israel have broken their covenant with you, torn down your altars, killed every one of your prophets. I am the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too. Go out and stand before me on the mountain, the Lord told him. As Elijah stood there, the Lord passed by, and the mighty windstorm hit the mountain. It was such a terrible blast that the rocks were torn loose, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake there was a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire there was the sound of a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And a voice said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he replied again, "I have zealously served the Lord God Almighty, but the people of Israel have broken their covenant with you, torn down your altars, killed every one of your prophets. I am the only one left. And now they are trying to kill me too." Then the Lord told him, "Go back the same way you came and travel to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive there, anoint Hazael to be king and anoint Elijah to replace you as my prophet." So Elijah went. So Elijah's just had this amazing spectacle happen where God has proved clearly and dramatically that he is present, he is in charge, that he is God. But a hot minute later, Jezebel threatens him, and Elijah is afraid and flees for his life. Not only that, he has the nerve to complain to God that all that he has done, that he has all done, and that all he wants is to die because he's having such a bad time of it. That's such a great story. It makes me so glad to know that I'm not the only one who turns tail and gives up sometimes in the face of opposition. So Elijah goes and sits under a broom tree and prays that God will kill him. Of course, he could easily just go back to Ahab and Jezebel and fulfill his own prayer, but he doesn't do that. Instead, he sits under his broom tree and hurts and grieves and cries in his soul. Do you have a broom tree? I wonder if you go there sometimes, sit under it, succumb to the demons of your own despair. Maybe you've done good things for God or for humans, exerted yourself, stepped out in faith, put your time and energy on the line, even achieved results, and then you crash. Have you felt that exhaustion that just doesn't melt away with a good night's sleep, but that attaches to your body and mind and soul like a creeping vine that strangles the hope out of you? Have you ever been so low and so unable to see a way up or out that you have uttered Elijah's prayer? I have a broom tree. It's my bed at 4 a.m. That's when the voices of doubt and despair rise up and overwhelm me. The perspective from under my broom tree is so skewed and out of focus that the challenges of life take on a size that makes them seem invincible. From where I lie under my broom tree, my resources are so puny that there's no way I can survive. I lose faith in my ability to do the simplest things. I believe the most absurd and dangerous lies that a few hours later, when I'm up and rested and nourished, I know are false. Now, it's not every night. It's not even most nights. In fact, it's fairly infrequent, but it lurks in the corner, never too far away, waiting for its moment. It's my broom tree. So notice how God responds to Elijah. He doesn't yell at him. He doesn't question the truth of his complaints. He doesn't tell him to get his sorry butt back and face Jezebel or stop feeling sorry for himself and buck up. God just lets Elijah be there under his broom tree. He lets him feel what he feels, and he gives him space. Eventually, Elijah rests and sleeps, and God looks after him. He sends angels to feed him and to bring him water, and he lets him sleep as long as he needs to. He lets him rest. Isn't that beautiful? He doesn't fix the problem. He doesn't tell Elijah to feel anything other than what he's feeling, and he just stays by him. He just lets him rest. I resist rest. Do you ever want to rest and feel like you can't? There's too much to do, life is too busy, or resting is for the weak? I do. But God offers us rest. Jesus in Matthew 11 says, "Come to me, you who are weak and burdened, and I will give you rest." And yet I keep popping up like the whack-a-mole, saying, no, I don't need rest, I'm good. God offers us rest because sometimes stopping, being quiet, resting, is what we need before we can move on. So Elijah stays there as long as he needs to gain his strength. We don't know how long that is, but it's long enough that he walked 40 days and 40 nights, so I assume he was there for a while. He doesn't, as far as we know where he's going. God hasn't told him what's next, and he's made it clear that he isn't interested in another assignment. But he goes into the desert and follows where he's led. Sometimes we don't know what's coming next, but long obedience means we trust the guide, and so we step on. Elijah gets to Mount Sinai, and it's clear that despite the rest and the food and the angels and all that, Elijah is still mad and sad. He says to God, "I've served you as hard as I could, but everybody else are bad guys, and now I'm the only good guy left, and they're trying to kill me." He effectively says, "I will not be cajoled out of this small pit I have dug for myself, no matter what comfort or support you offer." Ever feel like that? I do. But it's also interesting to me that despite the fact that Elijah is still mad and sad, he just walked 40 days in the desert because God told him to. Seemingly, that would be obedience in the same direction. That rest and silence and solitude in the company and presence of God have made it possible for Elijah to move ahead in his life, ultimately back to the work he's given to do, even if his feelings aren't repaired, even if he's still mad and sad, and even if he doesn't still feel good. So if we look at this story, long obedience sometimes means maybe taking a rest when we don't think we need it. It maybe means sometimes stepping away to let ourselves have the time and the silence and the absence of anything else to be loved and cared for by God and with God. It maybe means waiting in the desert and still taking another step, even if we don't know what's ahead. It maybe means carrying on in faith and obedience, even when we are still hurt and when we still feel alone and abandoned and even threatened with our very life. Even at the top of Mount Sinai, God isn't angry at Elijah. He doesn't tell him to buck up, to get over it. God again just listens to his cry and his fear and his worry, and he just lets it be what it is. I wonder if sometimes we expect God to be angry with our pain and our sadness, to demand that I do better, feel better, be better. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe that's not God. Maybe this kind, gentle, non-demanding God is the God who comes to us in those times that we need him. Anyway. Then God shows himself to Elijah, not in a big way, not in the wind or the earthquake, not even with a show of fire like which Elijah had just seen. But in a small whisper. Elijah's on a mountain, all by himself, after being alone for many, many days. And it occurs to me that God often speaks to me in a tiny whisper, and I wonder how often I don't hear it in the rush of noise that is my life and my ears. I wonder if it requires me to be in such a place of silence where all the other voices, all the other distractions are removed, where it is so quiet in our head and our heart that we can hear a tiny whisper. God gives Elijah the task of returning to where he came from to carry on the work. And without evidence in the story that Elijah feels any different, in fact, his response the second time to God, even hearing God's voice as a whisper, is still, "I've served you as hard as I could, but everybody else are bad, and now I'm the only good guy left and they're trying to kill me." Exactly the same response. I don't know, but I wonder if by the second time Elijah at least manages a little smile at his own self-indulgence. But whatever his feelings, he obeys and goes. And I suspect he goes with hope. Hope that God will be with him. Hope that this is a good idea. Hope that God knows what they're doing, even if he doesn't. Hope based on the knowledge that God has been there, that he is there, and that he will be there. Hope is based on his experience of God in the past. Hope is based on trust. Peterson says in his book, Long Obedience, "Hoping doesn't mean doing nothing. It's not fatalistic resignation. It means going about our assigned tasks, confident that God will provide the meaning and the conclusions. It's not compelled to work away at keeping up appearances with bogus spirituality. It is the opposite of desperate and panicky manipulations, of scurrying and worrying. And hoping is not about dreaming. It's not spinning an illusion or fantasy to protect us from our boredom or our pain. It means a confident, alert expectation that God will do what he said he will do. It is imagination put in the harness of faith. It's a willingness to let God do it his way and in his time." And I just want to take a second and have you note this, the painting behind me. A few years ago at True City, we actually titled a whole conference, Long Obedience. And Karen Black, who's an artist here in town, painted this picture, which is of the Wentworth Stairs. The Wentworth Stairs? The Wentworth Stairs, as this idea of long obedience. And it hangs in the back hall, but I wanted to bring it out today just because I think it's a helpful visual for us as we think about this idea of long obedience, most of which is going uphill. I realize I'm telling this story today as much for my own remembrance as for yours. Sorry. I've sat under a few broom trees in the desert in my life, exhausted, let down, confused, maybe mad, maybe sad. Even this summer, as I step away from my job, I wrestled with the fear and worry and discomfort of the not knowing. And having had the incredible privilege of time away and in silence, I still don't have answers to those questions, like Elijah didn't. But I try to step forward in the same direction and hope that God knows where we're going. I could talk all day about what I think I have learned in my longish, occasional obedience in mostly the same direction. But the need for regular periods of silence may be one of the most transformational discoveries I have made. It was Elijah's superpower, his spiritual superpower, and it is my spiritual superpower. And I recommend it to you. We don't all have the opportunity in our lives to take a day or several days on retreat or take a summer and go away somewhere and stare at the trees. But if you ever get the opportunity, grab it. But we can all find a few moments a day for silence. We can. You can find a few moments a day for silence. if you understand its value. And believe me when I say that every fiber of your being will resist it. Because it's hard. I can have an entire day ahead of me with nothing pressing, and I still find myself halfway through the morning going, I really should sit down and have some time in silence. And it just like, it's hard, man. I don't know. We just resist because it's this idea that we have to give up the control of our mind for a minute, that we just have to let the world carry on its axis for 5 minutes without us. And that's hard. And it's not because in silence I necessarily hear from God or I sort of get that sort of tiny whisper. I often don't. Rarely do I. But there's something about the practice of waiting, of quieting, of letting go of the running narrative of my life, even for 5 minutes, that calms me and centers me and lets me take that next step forward. Now, somebody here clearly needed to hear Psalm 131 today, because I chose to end this with Psalm 131, and Kevin chose to start us with Psalm 131, so that wasn't actually planned, but obviously one of you really needs to hear Psalm 131, or I do. This is a song for pilgrims ascending to Jerusalem. It's a song for those who are stepping out and stepping on long obedience. Peterson calls it a maintenance psalm. He says it is as functional to the person of faith as pruning is functional to the gardener. So let's just take a second and close our eyes if you feel so inclined. Leave them open if you want. And I'm just going to read this to us in closing. Lord, my heart is not proud. My eyes are not haughty. I don't concern myself with matters too great or too awesome for me to grasp. Instead, I have calmed and quieted myself like a child who no longer cries for its mother's milk. Yes, like a child is my soul within me. O Israel, put your hope in the Lord, now and always. Amen.